Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today was a day for old guys and old companies. Warren Buffett plowed $6 billion into Wrigley, the chewing gum company. Fellow billionaire Kirk Kerkorian prefers Ford. He snapped up 5% of that company in just the past 3 weeks. So I guess if you stick around long enough, you probably do learn some things. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Angie's List, providing first-hand homeowner reviews on local contractors like plumbers, painters, and movers. Details at angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 28th of April. Great to have you here. Warren Buffett is 77 years old. Kirk Kerkorian is 90. Each of them has a net worth well into the 10-figure range. So when they start throwing their money around, people pay attention. Mars, the candy company that makes M&Ms, among many other confections, is teaming up with Buffett to buy Wrigley for $23 billion. The Mars-Wrigley combo is going to be the biggest candy company in the world. Kirk Kerkorian started buying Ford shares back at the beginning of this month. He owns almost 5% of that car maker already. Announced today he wants more. Almost makes you forget all about subprimes and the credit crunch now, doesn't it? Our New York Bureau Chief Joe Barchet reports.
Warren Buffett and Kirk Kerkorian aren't the only billionaires shopping for bargains in this market. Wilbur Ross has been buying mortgage companies, too. Quincy Crosby is chief investment strategist of The Hartford. She says the example set by these heavyweights may lure more buyers back into the market.
Very, very experienced investors with terrific track records see value. That's a very good sign. What has been missing in this market has been confidence.
Crosby says the reentry of long-term investors is a sign that the market is bottoming out. But it has a way to go. Mitchell Corwin is a candy industry analyst at Morningstar. He points out that Mars had to go cap in hand to Buffett.
I think it speaks to that there's still some turbulence in the credit markets, that Mars had to creatively finance this acquisition of Wrigley.
Robert Teitelman is the editor of The Deal. He says the smart money thinks now is an ideal time to buy beaten-down assets.
Buffett is always most effective in markets where everybody else is desperate or fearful. He has the cash. He's got a giant war chest there. Kirk Kerkorian and his vehicle, Tresinda, are in the same position.
But Buffett and Kerkorian aren't like other investors. All the cash they've got stockpiled in those war chests acts as a cushion, which they may need if the markets keep giving all of us a bumpy ride. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
United Airlines is clearly hoping to catch some of that deal-making magic. Last week, Continental said thanks but no to a get-together. The buzz today was all about United and U.S. Airways. Nobody's confirming anything, mind you, but shares of U.S. Air were up more than 20%. The proximate cause of aviation merger fever continues unabated. Oil nudged ever closer to $120 a barrel. $119.93 was the top. Two theoretically unrelated labor disputes were largely to blame. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Workers at an oil refinery in Scotland are on a two-day strike. The dispute is over pension rights and is completely local, but it sent ripples around the globe. The refinery supplies power to one of the main pipelines pumping oil in from the North Sea. The pipeline was shut down, preventing the delivery of 700,000 barrels of crude a day. Commodities analyst Nicholas Brooks.
In normal times, perhaps the impact wouldn't be so huge. But in an environment like we're in today, where you have very, very tight supply, the impact can actually be quite large in the very short term. And we've certainly seen that today in the markets.
To make matters worse, workers striking over pay knocked out Exxon's facilities in Nigeria. Together, the two disputes cut global supplies by 2%. That's especially worrying, says oil analyst Philip Verliger, because this is the high-quality crude needed to make the cleaner fuels that are mandatory in the US and Europe.
The light sweet crudes, such as produced in Nigeria or come out of the North Sea, are very desirable because it's much easier to remove the sulfur.
The Scottish refinery workers are threatening further action, and there's no end in sight for the Nigerian dispute. Some analysts are warning the worst oil supply disruption in recent years is set to continue, putting even further upward pressure on the price. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve set for a two-day meeting on interest rates tomorrow and the next day. That means all the bigwigs like Mr. Bernanke will be in Washington. The Fed's work is never done, though. Fed staffers are in Los Angeles today and tomorrow. They're holding hearings on Bank of America's planned acquisition of the troubled mortgage company Countrywide, which is based out here. If the deal passes muster, B of A would become the largest mortgage lender in the country. Fair lending advocates say that with that market power comes an obligation to help clients avoid foreclosure. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler was at the hearing.
Cloyd Miller came to the hearing from Rancho Cucamonga, where he bought a home several years ago. Miller says Countrywide mismanaged his loan, and ultimately he declared bankruptcy.
When I filed in 2007 with bankruptcy, my lawyer told me that 70% of her clients were from Countrywide.
Miller thinks Bank of America has a responsibility to clean up Countrywide's mess. In a written statement, Bank of America says it, quote, expects to modify or work out at least $40 billion in troubled mortgage loans in the next 2 years. But Fair Finance advocate Alan Fisher with the California Reinvestment Coalition says Bank of America needs to provide more solid details about its plan. Fisher suggests many risky loans need to be revalued.
We think the house should be valued at what it would be at auction so that it's the real value now. And then we think 75% of subprime borrowers could afford those homes.
Some homeowners will face foreclosure. Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters says she's not asking the bank to shoot itself in the foot financially.
We're not asking them to be irresponsible and to put themselves at some great risk of not being paid. What we're saying is there are many people who, with a little time and attention, can get workouts and modifications to help them stay in the loans.
Several proposals to help borrowers and the industry are working through Congress. Bank of America's $4 billion acquisition of Countrywide is expected to be completed by July. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Countrywide reports quarterly profits tomorrow, by the way. Wall Street was all set for a nice sugar high today after that Mars-Wrigley deal. Then Warren Buffett went and said the economy is not only already in a recession, it's going to be worse than everybody thinks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've talked before on the program about a run on the banks. Thankfully, that is not in the news today, but there does appear to be a run on the post office. 2 weeks from today, the cost of mailing a first-class letter goes up a penny, from 41 cents to 42. That is, unless you've bought a 41-cent forever stamp, which will work for exactly that long. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington. Those babies are flying off the shelves at a rate of 30 million a day.
The Forever stamp is only a year old, but 6 billion have been sold so far, says Dave Partenheimer at the Postal Service.
And the demand for them in the last few weeks has really shot up.
That's because in 2 weeks, the cost of buying a Forever stamp will rise by a penny. Not a big deal, so why is everyone stampeding to the stamp machines?
Now they're saying they're going to raise a penny. And the next thing you know, they're going to raise 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies. God knows how frequently they can do that.
Marketing professor John Zhang at the Wharton School says people see a good investment and they're stocking up even if they don't need the stamps right now. He says the Postal Service is taking advantage of a basic economic principle.
In the durable goods industry, normally what you want to do is to create this impression that the price is really on the way up. So if you're thinking of buying the product, you better buy it now.
So the seller's boosting sales and the buyer's getting a bargain. The only loser appears to be the now less popular 1 cent stamp. It will remain an annoyance forever. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Last May, the United States ended a postal service that had been around as long as the country had, sending letters and packages by sea. It's airmail only now for most international postage. From Great Britain, commentator Robert Lyle wonders whether the change has been worth it.
It's been 300 years since regular seagoing shipments of mail first started. Today, most mail goes by air. So it seemed perfectly natural for the U.S. Postal Service to stop using ships and put everything on planes. After all, less than 3% of international mail went by sea anyway, and air package traffic has been growing for several years now. eBay sellers just one factor. Sounds wonderful, but at what a price. For example, a 2-pound packet of research papers used to cost around $8 to send by surface to Europe. The same package now costs 4 times as much. Charities that send clothing, books, and other essentials to the poor in third world countries have been hit even harder. They used to be able to send their aid in so-called M-bags at very low sea rates. Now, the mail is just too expensive. The charities are looking for ways around this new hurdle. They want to use the law which allows free shipments to the blind and disabled. But Congress doesn't allow the USPS to use profits from one class of mail to pay for another. It's all driven by economics of scale. Big shippers can still get sea mail as long as they can fill a 40-foot-long container by themselves. Or if they spend millions on expensive mail products like express mail, they get sea mail as a bonus. So the little guys are having to learn to work together. They can use one of 20 or so authorized postal wholesalers to combine their shipments to fill a container. It's not perfect, but it helps. That just leaves we individuals. I recently had a package sent by air from the States, and it took 24 days to fly to Britain. That's about the same time it would have taken to come by sea. Not much has changed, except, of course, the price.
Robert Lyle is a semi-retired international economics journalist. You can send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org, or for 41 cents, you can write us. 261 South Figueroa Street is the address, Los Angeles, California, 90012. It should be a pretty good time at IBM's annual shareholder meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina tomorrow. After Big Blue reported a 25% jump in profits a couple of weeks ago, the stock is near a 6-year high. But employees aren't feeling any of that love. Workers are planning to protest the meeting over something called reclassification. The word's getting a lot of play in corporate America these days and in the courts, too, as Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains.
It was just another workday for David Canizares, a network administrator for IBM. Then his boss called him in and gave him the news.
They said that they wanted to be more compliant with federal regulations, so they were going to take us from exempt status to non-exempt status.
That was a fancy way of telling Canizares he still had a full-time job with benefits, but he'd no longer be classified as a salaried worker. He would be paid by the hour, and that wasn't the biggest change.
They had to cut our pay 15%.
IBM said the cut was necessary because the reclassified workers would now get to earn overtime. In fact, to make the same pay as before, those workers would have to put in extra hours. But for a third of the reclassified employees at IBM, working overtime isn't a possibility. So they're taking home less money.
It's about the bottom line.
Christopher David Ruiz Cameron teaches labor law at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Welcome, he says, to the modern workplace.
Every manager's job is to figure out how to get as few employees do the most work for as little money as possible. There's nothing evil about that. That's just how it works.
But as more companies have cut costs by reclassifying workers, the lawsuits just keep coming.
There's a reason why they call wage and hour litigation the plaintiff lawyer's Full Employment Act.
One case that's dragged on for years has to do with agents at insurance company Allstate. They filed a class action against the company after being reclassified as independent contractors back in 1999 and being told they couldn't collect overtime. In some cases, courts have found workers haven't been fairly compensated.
In the last 10 to 15 years, major settlements for millions of dollars to settle wage and hour claims for unpaid overtime and rest breaks and meal breaks has been paid out by Starbucks, by Microsoft.
Then there's the ongoing case of FedEx. A federal judge ruled in late March that class action suits can proceed in 19 states against the company over how some of its drivers are classified. The company calls many of them independent contractors, while the workers say they're expected to perform like staffers without the associated benefits. So far, they've had little choice but to like it or leave it.
Do we always need that kind of tension, whether it's picking between having a pay cut or having a job?
That's Lee Conrad of the Alliance at IBM. He's been trying to organize workers at the computer giant to protect not just their pay, but their jobs. He says in an age of globalization and cheap labor, workers know they can easily be replaced.
Anybody that works behind a computer can see their jobs outsourced to India, China, or South America.
IBM workers upset over their new hourly status and the pay cut that comes with it have been circulating an online petition since February. They want their pay to be restored. They've also filed a class action suit demanding overtime. And there's the protest tomorrow at the shareholder meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina. Their voices may be heard, but no one is holding out much hope that the situation will change anytime soon. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, in China, finding dates with real estate.
It's not fair. Even if you're really rich and buying a house is as easy as buying a piece of chocolate, it's still not fair.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks stayed near the center line today, as they often do, just ahead of an interest rate decision from the Fed that is due on Wednesday. The Dow Industrial shaved off 0.1%, 20 points, to finish at 12,871. The Nasdaq edged a tiny fraction higher, just a single point, wrapped up trading at 2424. The S&P 500 dipped 0.1%, 1 point lower, ending at 1369. Nobody was snickering about that big candy biz takeover we told you about earlier. Wrigley shares sweetened up by 23%. Investors also planted one on Hershey. Its stock rose more than 4.5% on speculation it could soon be wrapped up in a merger. We also mentioned Kirk Kerkorian's bid to jack up his stake in Ford. Shares accelerated almost 10% there. GM shares motored up more than 2.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note sank to 3.83%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. In Washington, the Federal Reserve opens a two-day meeting to discuss interest rates. And the Senate Judiciary Committee talks about kids living on the street. They'll focus on ways to protect homeless and runaway youth. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. They're still high by historic levels, but it might be worth pointing out food commodities fell today. Rice, wheat, and soybean prices were all lower. Whether or not that'll eventually lower global food prices themselves, we don't know yet. But even if it does, it probably won't happen soon enough to help the world's poorest consumers, the hundreds of millions of people who live on a dollar a day or less. Washington Post reporter Anthony Fiola met some of them recently in Mauritania in Western Africa.
It's a broken cycle of food that you're seeing there. Often you'll find that the adults are saving food, giving it to their children, eating less themselves. It makes them weaker and weaker. If there are mothers, for instance, with infants, some of them would stop lactating because they're not getting the nutrition that they need in order to breastfeed their babies.
What money they do have, where's it coming from?
It depends. Often they're goat herds, often they're cattle herds. What we're finding, though, sadly, is that there's a situation where people are selling off their goats. They're selling off their futures often in order to be able to buy food for their families.
You found a man, actually, who was selling his last goat, right?
Absolutely. It was a situation where this man had, and his family, they had 5 goats last year. And over the last year, as prices have gone up for food, they've been forced to sell the goats one by one or eat the goats in order to have food for dinner, etc. He had a bright smile and bright eyes. But when we first saw him, we saw none of that. We saw a father trying to feed his children. I mean, he seemed like he was a man on a mission. One thing that he told us that really stuck into my head was that tonight's dinner is more important than tomorrow's breakfast. And that really is the motto that they're living on.
Did he find a buyer for the goat?
He didn't. One of the great problems that they're having right now is that there are so many people like him in Mauritania that are being forced to sell their livestock, but the prices for goats are actually falling. So he'll take a goat to market, but no one is willing to pay the price that was the going rate, say, a month or two ago. So he made the decision that he was going to wait a few days, hopefully see if he could find another buyer. So normally he would also be a day laborer, but he's been unable to find work lately. And this was something that we found very common because there doesn't seem to be a lot of work lately there.
Is it your sense that Mauritania is different from a lot of countries in Africa?
What makes Mauritania different to some extent is the fact that it is what we call a country in a food trap. It has to import roughly 70% of its food supply. So the fluctuations of prices in global trade come to roost more quickly and more directly in a place like Mauritania. And of course, the irony is that these are countries that can afford it least. They're very poor countries.
There's emergency aid. There's the World Food Program. There's the United Nations. What about the government of Mauritania and other governments in Africa?
Well, the government of Mauritania right now is trying to double their agricultural output by the end of the year. Now, there are a lot of people who feel that this is just simply too ambitious a goal to achieve, especially for a country that is on the edge of the Sahara and not exactly in the most ideal climatic situation. But that said, they are trying to undo the last 15 years of basically abandoning the idea of growing more food. This year, they've designated it the Year of Agriculture there. So they are taking some steps. The question is it going to be enough, and is it going to happen quickly enough? And I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Anthony Fiola covers globalization for The Washington Post. The paper's series on the global food crisis started this past week, and it runs through Thursday. Anthony, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We all know what's going to work with members of the opposite sex. Charm, wit, intelligence, good looks never hurt, a promising career is always helpful. Roll all those together and you can pretty much guarantee a busy weekend for 20 or 30-somethings on the dating scene here in the United States. In big cities over in China, though, that's just not going to cut it. Lisa Chow reports now from Beijing. A broad real estate portfolio is a necessary aphrodisiac.
Yeah, real estate prices are going up, and maybe it's a good investment. But young men say here's the real reason they became homeowners. It helps a lot in the dating game. Vincent Gall says the first thing most single women want to know is whether you own. Then they'll want to know if you paid for the apartment in cash, because a loan means big, ugly mortgage payments.
It's not fair. Even if you're really rich and buying a house is as easy as buying a piece of chocolate, it's still not fair.
Luckily, the 28-year-old owns three apartments. On this evening, Gao hangs out with his friend Peter Yang in one of Beijing's new hip pool halls. Yang says apartment size matters, so does location. It's best to own inside what's known as the Second Ring Road.
If you live very far, like Fifth Ring Road or Sixth, then the girl will bring the issue whether you have a car. Then if you have a car, the distance can be compensated somehow.
He laughs at the expression on my face.
It's not funny. I don't think it's funny.
You don't think it's funny?
I don't think so. It's a very reasonable. If I'm a girl, I will also ask. It's not. It's about your life. You cannot hide it.
Yang says women are simply looking for a better life. So I asked two women how they evaluate potential mates. Aixing Jue Luo Yujia is 28. She works as an event planner and she's married.
I was definitely looking for someone who had a house, because I believe this fact demonstrates his potential, and it gave me a sense of security.
Her friend Cheng Jing is single. She's 30 and works at a Swiss pharmaceutical company.
We're living in a modern society. Why think so traditionally about such things? Love is the most important thing for me.
Besides, Cheng says, if she really needs to buy a house and can't afford it, her parents will help. Her friend tells her she shouldn't rely on her parents for those things. Any money her parents give her should be saved to help them down the road, when they're old. So here's the expectation on young women. Marry up so you can bring something back to the parents. Vincent Gao takes me and my interpreter, Zhang Han Shao, to one of his three apartments. He bought it a year and a half ago, and since then, prices have gone up 80% in this neighborhood. Yes, he used a loan, and yes, it's far from the center of Beijing. But Gao has a car, and the apartment is huge.
Like two-floor apartment.
Gao takes us to the second living room in the apartment. At this point, I can tell my single 24-year-old interpreter is impressed.
Gorgeous.
The financial pressure on young men and their families to buy real estate, I found, persists across income lines. One cab driver in his 30s told me he was happy he had a daughter. Knowing Chinese still prefer having sons, I asked why. He said because as a driver, he was in no financial position to help a son buy a house. In Beijing, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, as bad as you think you've got it at the gas pump, pity the diesel driver. The Energy Department announced today diesel's averaging $4.18 a gallon. Truckers drove their rigs through Washington, D.C. today to protest those high prices. They said it costs about $1,200 to fill up a big rig. Think for a second about what's inside a lot of those trucks, stuff like food and electronics, and then think about how much more it's all going to start costing sometime soon. That is Marketplace on this Monday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 20 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 1 point. That's a tiny fraction. The S&P 500 lost a point. That is a tenth of 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, the rising price of keeping up your condo.
It's just a cascade effect of where if you keep reducing the number of residents, you're ultimately going to raise the dues for everybody else that remains. And when people can't take it anymore, it usually means the death of the community.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.